day pretty well of April, only a week off the 50th anniversary celebration or commemoration of VE Day, because I'm more interested in VJ, but they wanted me to talk, the two of them, a little bit about the army and the 6 years of my life that it occupied, because I was only, 23, 24, when I was called up. We knew this was going to happen. Hitler had been marching through Europe, and we were unprepared as a nation, and gradually it dawned on us that we ought to do something. We had a very ineffectual leader in Chamberlain, and he tried to accept bits of paper from Hitler, but it didn't go anywhere. And eventually the order came through that everybody would be conscripted. At least all the young males from 18 onwards would be conscripted. And this was about 1938. And our firm in due course announced that nobody must volunteer, that they must wait until they are called. And the early ones went, and a lot of them went into the army, but a lot of them went into the mines. And I think there are two friends in the Isle of Man who preferred rather a conscientious service in the mines. I was duly called up, and I'd not long had an operation for appendicitis, and they said I would be grade 2 or whatever, and I would have to do clerical work and sort of be a write-up, which didn't appeal to me at all. But I was deferred, and I thought, well, during that period I will volunteer. And the sort of service that appealed to me was possibly the Navy and the Army and the Signals. Well, of course, when I had gone up first of all and been medically tested, they said, well, the Navy's full. Unless you've got a brother, sister or whatever connected with the Navy, there's not much chance. So I then thought, volunteer I would for the Signals, which I did. And by this time I was past A1, though I know I shouldn't have been because of subsequent events. And by that time, this was May 1940, Hitler had invaded the Low Countries, France was invaded, the French army and the British were retreating. It was a desperate situation, and all you got was a little letter saying, report to somewhere near Worksop, which is near Doncaster, I think about the 29th of May, 1940, and join. It didn't even give the name of the unit I was to join. Whereupon I set off with, I think, just my toilet accessories and possibly a spare shirt, I'm not too sure, and found my way to this place, which was a stately home right in the heart of Retford or Nottinghamshire. And it really was amazing, because there was a cavalry unit, a yeomanry unit from London, with their stables and their horses around this stately home. And I found some sort of an office, and they said, well, you know, what are you doing here? Well, I said, this is my bit of paper. They want me for the army and the Signals. Good God. Well, we're on our way to France. The army's retreating there. We're ready to go any day. We don't want the likes of you. This is a little bit off-putting, but it didn't make any difference. I thought I got a uniform, but no, they hadn't got a uniform. They weren't prepared for that sort of thing. They didn't want anybody. Whereupon they started injecting me for all sorts of foreign diseases, because they were going off to wild parts of Europe where they might get malaria and yellow fever and Lord knows what. And there were, I think there were 3 or 4 other individuals like myself who had turned up because the War Office had decided that we would make up the strength of some unit or another, regardless of our training. And we languished for a few days while this unit would blow trumpets in the morning for bedding down the horses or cleaning the harness or whatever. And we started on our 6 years army experience, whereupon they decided that they would get rid of us quickly, and they sent us off to, I think, their territorial establishment in London, which was at Putney. And there we started training. Now, that's the introduction of how I got into the army. I don't know whether you want to ask any questions or should I have a little pause there? Well, now, what were you thinking of saying, Mother?
I was just going to comment on the fact that from your account of the horses and the yeoman brigade, was it, a yeomanry? It sounds almost as though we were back in the days of the Crimea. And as far as preparation for war was concerned, I don't think any nation could have been less prepared or ready for it than England. I, at the time, was in London at college. I'd gone there in 1939 to 1940, and we were still there in 1940. But after we'd spent the summer holiday at home, our return to London was postponed and, in fact, given up altogether, and we were evacuated to Weston-super-Mare, as indeed were so many people at the time. Evacuation was begun then, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, you're perfectly right. There was an air of unpreparedness, and we are talking about what was called the phony war, except that the U-boats had been at it since the previous September, and there had been bombing raids on things like light ships and lighthouses. Curious way of running a war. And then suddenly it all erupted, and Europe from then on will never be the same, because of course they were in Paris in a very short time. My cousin Tom and my uncle Seymour were evacuating the troops from Dunkirk, from Saint-Malo, from Le Havre, from Brest in the Manx vessels. That's another story. But I went to London there to train, and training was pretty stiff. It was announced that there would be no Saturday afternoons in future, and a 7-day week, and we must train vigorously and rigorously and so on. And you could see London still getting itself ready, still getting sandbags, still carrying on, and wondering really what it was all about.
Wasn't one of the first casualties of the war a ship being torpedoed? Was it the Athenia?
Yes, that was within days of the war, pretty
yes, but
well.
That
yes,
was one of the first casualties.
That's one of the first casualties.
It just shows that Germany was prepared and we were not.
Well, oh, absolutely. And of course, by the end of May, they had taken over France and were in Paris and conducted a peace. And Churchill was giving those marvellous speeches that we will fight on, because we were then in danger of being invaded. And of course we were on watch every night and so on. And within a month, because they hadn't really been able to launch an attack by sea, they launched an attack by air, and London was the first to catch it. And I think I moved billets about three times, we were bombed. But it was nothing where we were in Putney compared with the East End, where you could see the flames at night lighting up the entire sky as though the whole of London were burning. And as twilight would fall, you would see the buses rushing along the road to get back to depot, the wardens out and so on, and you would go on fire watching or something like that. I know, I think we were in one school and a landmine fell and blasted the school pretty well to pieces. We were lucky to escape. But we went on training, and then It got worse, really, not better. The bombing got worse. Daylight bombing, and you could see the hundreds of silver bombers up in the sky and the fighters weaving round, and you could hear the rat-tat-tat of the machine guns. And that was London as I remember it, until I was sent away to Hull. But here Mother's going to interrupt.
Meantime, of course, the bombs were beginning to fall very heavily on Merseyside. Do you remember that? Wasn't it in the winter of 1940-41 that Liverpool was so... the whole of the dock area of Liverpool was bombed?
Yes, you're moving on a bit, but I was in Hull then, and they started on Liverpool after they had a very good go at London. Having done Morse training for a month or so at Hull, I think we went into Suffolk, to Newmarket, and it was there that word came to me that my home had been bombed, and that I was granted, I think, 3 days' compassionate leave to go home and find out the house was shattered pretty well, and my sister was recovering what bits of precious items she could, and they were all put in some furniture van and taken away into storage, and Mother and Mabel went out to stay with Uncle Jack and Auntie Reenie at Williston.
Didn't you find, too, that the wardrobe was pulled across the front door to stop anyone looting the house with a notice on it? What was on the notice?
Yes, there was a notice in red print there, warning any looting will be punished immediately by death. And you stepped inside wondering if somebody was looking out at you and ready to report you as a looter, but of course I was in service uniform. And there were still some people around. Some had been killed locally, but there were still some people around who would have known me. And in those few days, we did what we could to recover precious things.
Wasn't this the result of a landmine? A parachute bomb, wasn't it?
Well, they sent landmines down on parachutes, and they saw it lodge in the tree. I think this is the air raid warden. He was the one that was killed, and his companion survived. But that's how it was then, and that was the end of the phony war. Now being trained in Morse, the next thing was somehow to prepare for D-Day. And I'm talking about 1941 then, so that commando units were being formed, landing units were being formed, and we became part of the training to provide the signals as soon as a landing had been effected on the European coast. And this was quite early in 1941. And I think we started courting about then by telephone mainly, didn't we?
Yes.
And I only got about one or two leaves.
Yes, it was about that time that we became engaged, I think, wasn't it?
Well, it was the beginning of 42. 41, I think we had moved up to Scotland and we were in Melrose and doing imaginary landings there. And then Inverary we were, with an entire ship's convoy anchored at Inverary, ready to put us on any day, any night, to go off to some wild part of the Scottish countryside, land on some rough beach, set up a signal office, set out landing lines, get communications going, and then go back on board ship and be ready for the next one. And I think we got very little leave, but in one of those leaves, I think it was January, about the time of my mother's birthday or your mother's birthday, that we became engaged.
That's right, yes. I think you described to me at that time, too, how you would be making an assault, say, on a cliff or something to prepare yourself for landing somewhere, assaulting, assault course, and so many men completely with their haversacks and equipment and guns and so on, fell into the water and into the loch and were drowned. That still haunts me, such a waste of life.
Oh yes, inevitably. With an entire convoy, and we were on a big Polish North Atlantic liner called a Batory, fine ship, but some of the landing into the small craft, she went down rope, not ladders properly, but rope nets with your rifle, your kit, your water can filled and Lord knows what's rations, and climb down there. And if you slipped, of course, with that weight, you went straight to the bottom and there was no picking you up. And there were quite a few lost like that. But of course, that was nothing compared with the thought of landing on the beaches in Europe. And it was 1943, I think, before they made one attempt at that. And that was an absolute disaster. Whereabouts was that? Was it Mountbatten there?
It was the Canadians, wasn't it?
The Canadians were wiped out pretty well. So it wasn't a very comfortable task, that. But in 1942, we would only been engaged a month when the Japs broke through from Malaya and Vietnam, and the French, unfortunately, had been helping them, made it easy, and they broke into Burma very quickly. And they were through Burma. Now, Hitler had broken through into Russia and gone right through to the, pretty well to the Urals, and certainly to Sevastopol and the Black Sea and that area, nearly reaching the valuable oil wells. And the Japanese were intent on breaking through India and Afghanistan and joining up there. And they would rule the world. And that was the scenario, really, where with the Americans fighting in the Pacific,
Before the Americans came in, of course, we were completely alone. Norway had been overrun by the Germans. Italy had come in on Germany's side. The whole of the European coast was occupied, and England quite literally stood alone, didn't she?
Yes, and without the leadership and the courage of Churchill, I don't see how we could have kept on. But kept on we did, and we provided a base from which the Americans were able to fight in Europe.
But the Americans, of course, didn't come in until they were attacked, which was quite different from England. England was the only country that came in without having been
attacked.
That's right.
Morally, everything was on our side. A fact that's not really appreciated today. And without it, with Hitler dominating the entire Europe, the landmass there, along with the Italians and Mussolini, there would have been no foothold if we had given in for them to be defeated, so that the evil, and we all know now how evil the dictatorship of Hitler was, there would have been no way of conquering Europe that was feasible anyway. But it's not to go about the war, it's to go just about an idea of what it was like for six of those years, which instead of being trained and worked through winters and summers and camped up on the hillsides and in Scotland, being beaten to death by mosquitoes, and landing at 01:30 with breakfast at 11:30 p.m. and so on. After all that training, suddenly, with the Japs breaking through, everything was switched, and we were taken out of our training. One of our sections had captured, I think, or recaptured Madagascar, and we went on board ship thinking we were going to French Caribbean, Martinique. Anyway, this was not so, because we knew jolly well by then that we'd got tropical kit and woe betide anybody who lost their pith helmet and didn't wear it every hour of the day he was out in the sun when it, once he got to India. And we went through the much bombed docks of Glasgow to join a fine P&O vessel called the Strathnava, which normally takes about 1,000-1,200 people and had 5,000 troops on. So that it was a bit like a slave ship, really, where the holds were occupied by entire companies who slung hammocks above the tables where they ate and whose sweat dropped down onto the tables there in terrific heat because, of course, she wasn't properly ventilated in the troop areas. And once she got going, there was a shortage of water and shortage of everything, really. I think you got 2 mugs a day supplied morning and evening. And during the day, it was possible, I think, to buy a mug of tea at a sort of a bit of a canteen there. But water was rationed badly. And we set off in a big convoy off to Iceland, then to New York, then to the Azores, then to St. Helena, making a zigzag way in this huge convoy, taking an entire month to reach Cape Town and Durban, where we stopped for a week. And I'll give a little pause there. Well, if I continue life aboard ship, because it was a month going to Africa, and it was a month from Africa, well, almost a month from Africa to Bombay, because, of course, in both cases we were avoiding submarine areas. Certainly there was Jap submarines around Madagascar. There were U-boats all over the Atlantic, and I mean, you did Iceland and very rough weather. You did going around very close to New York. And then, of course, it got hot. And, of course, then it became intolerable. I know we used to go around in football shorts and gym shoes and sweating profusely because below decks it really was pretty terrible. You could go on deck at certain times and you were on parade on decks at certain times. And, of course, if you could see us there below decks, it was a bit like the slave ships, because you would see a great big hairy Scotsman there, a member of the Highland Light Infantry or whatever, with sweat dripping off his sleeves and elbows, and as he would bend to do something, it would pour down there. And these chaps were so fed up. There was some sort of a mutiny where one night they broke into the liquor store and got themselves pretty drunk. It looked as though they might take over the ship. So they summoned all the more sober types around, and we were on guard and on gangways, stairways and all the rest of it with sticks to deal with these huge brutes of infantrymen from the Highland and the Queen's Own Camerons and Lord knows what. And eventually we didn't land in Freetown, we came to Freetown. And as a great concession, at night we were allowed on deck. And it didn't matter if it poured with rain, but at least you weren't confined to a hammock, nudging the next hammock and sweating profusely all night long. It had its moments to spot St. Helena in the early morning. There was quite an occasion to see the entire convoy rocking and rolling steadily, only about 5 or 6 knots, because we had bad boiler trouble. We couldn't make any speed if we tried, because ships hadn't been overhauled, hadn't been maintained, and the speed of the convoy was the speed of the slower ship. and you would watch the destroyers waltzing around. And I know as signals, we did a lot on ships, particularly when we were in Scotland. We would be on the deck doing the Morse lamp signalling, Aldous lamp. And I know when we went into Freetown, I was on the deck of this fine Strathnava there, watching the beautifully clad in white officers putting her alongside, not alongside, within one cable of another huge Atlantic liner, all done so efficiently. And then we eventually landed in Durban. Well, by having been a month sweating through the tropics and not able to do it, take any exercise hardly or do anything, we were then put on full kit, rifles and all the rest of it, and I think greatcoats, if I'm not mistaken, and we marched in great heat through the streets of Durban to the racecourse. Well, the troops were falling out like flies. They were not properly fed, exhausted by the troubles, and I think we had a few days in the racecourse at Durban before we embarked again on the same ship for Bombay. And we were perilously close to Jap submarines with a very much smaller convoy this time. Only I think one. I think we had the Shropshire, a three-funnel cruiser with us. That was about all. And I think one other ship. And somehow we managed to rendezvous somewhere in the Indian Ocean, I think, with, I think it was the Queen Elizabeth, QE2, on her way from Australia to Middle East, packed with troops. And then eventually we drew near land and the smells of the East and the Orient came out to us. And we were in Bombay and allowed ashore there for a day, I think, where I think I bought a present for Mother. And sent it off, I don't know what it was, silk or something like that, which I don't think eventually came as a parcel of rags in the true Indian fashion. And within a day, we were put on a troop train, quite a good troop train, but we were on it for 7 days and seven nights.
May I just interrupt for a moment? You're quite right about that lovely parcel that you did send, and it was rags. And I remember opening the vestibule in our house, which was at Mount Road, Birkenhead, and I could smell the parcel before I opened it. And my disappointment when I opened it, and there it was, filthy old Indian rags that should have been lovely silk. I'm sorry to interrupt, but do go on.
Well, that's the way it was. And, of course, I think communication would have been that you could have sent something from South Africa, I think, without letting your loved ones know that you were actually in Durban or wherever it was. I think they got some sort of communication. And then in India, obviously, because, of course, return journeys via the Cape would take a month or two, there wasn't much point in sending a letter. And they devised a system of photographing lettergraphs, or I think they had a name like that, and you got a sheet of paper and you could write out a message on it, and it was photographed, and then it was flown, the film was flown home, and within a week or so they would get some sort of a message from you. But you could go weeks without hearing from home, or home hearing from you. And I think as soon as we got off that train in India, which was an experience in itself to spend 7 days travelling through India at a rather slow pace and left in sidings occasionally and forgotten, I think, to find that we arrived at a place not very far from, in Bengal, from Calcutta, to be told that the war minister, the war defence minister, had announced that service in India had been increased from 7 to 8 years, and that was our greeting in India.
His name was, he was the son of Lord Altrincham, I can't remember his name, but I must say I disliked that man profoundly. It added another 2 months, I think, wasn't it, to our separation?
Well, I don't know what it did in the end, because, of course, nobody could see getting home, really, until the war were finished. And we really didn't know how we could possibly get into Burma to win, to defeat them. Ships and landing just weren't available. They were being concentrated in Europe. So there wasn't much hope for us. So that, in a sense, we had quite a soft time for a while, training and doing army signal work in and around the Calcutta area, until eventually we went into the Arakan, or a long, long journey to Chittagong, really, in which you take trains, little jungle trains, and river boats, paddle boats, and then other little trains, and eventually come to the white man's death area around Chittagong.
Could you describe sometime what sort of food, what your conditions were like?
Oh, well, food was in very short supply, British food, because, of course, they were rushing troops over, and they were not able to give the normal supplies. Food was absolutely atrocious. Goat's meat would be a sort of a goat's meat stew would be something. You went to look at your tea, and a brew of tea would be swarming in black ants, and the cook would skim the swarming black ants off the top. The meat you would perhaps see come in black with flies. And it wasn't long, of course, between a lot of illness took place, which was our experience in those conditions. I think a third of us were either sick or in hospital, sometimes with Bengal stomach, as they called it, sometimes with Sanfi fever, worse still with malaria, quite often with dysentery, you know. And if you're not in a very fit condition, these things strike, and it certainly prolonged our training there, I think, while we got ourselves into some sort of order. Trying to give you a coherent account of something that happened more than 50 years ago is not easy, and certainly not easy to give in chronological order, because, of course, you experienced a variety of conditions. Some billets were impossible. Swarming in bed bugs, the flies bad, latrines, you lifted the lid on something and a whole host of flies would rush up, and underneath there's a seething mass of lava, and it's no wonder that people had various forms of dysentery in no time at all. And there was a great deal of sickness. But sometimes the billets were quite good. It might be a convent somewhere, and reasonable, you know, with a reasonable space and so on. I know in one billet there in Calcutta, it turned out we were next door to a man who was the general manager for the Prudential in India. I don't know how I found this out, but he invited me in to dinner there, and very pleasant. And it turned out that in that house, a friend of ours here in the Isle of Man, Joe Males, was living there shortly before this next manager took over. He was our Prudential man there. So,
what was the name of the road?
It's Raja Santosh Road, Alipur, Calcutta. And then I fancy we were working in the Viceregal Palace doing signals and big radios down in the basement there, and sometimes with the Americans. And I know on one occasion the fighting was desperate up on the border at Imphal and Kohima. And I know I was sent up there with a load of ammunition, and it was a wonderful experience because, of course, the fighting there in the jungle was maintained by a road, which it was, I think, the Manipur Road it was originally, or some called it the Burma Road. But it was hacked out of the forest and out of the steep hills and wound its way for many, many miles. And it was done almost by aboriginally tribesmen who were really quite an experience to see. And all the way along there, where lorries had gone over the side of the cliffs, there were burnt out lorries or tanks or whatever. And of course, Imphal, by the time I got there, was fortunately over the worst, but they had had the worst that the Japanese could give them. And bitter fighting took place there, and it's still a memorial to the Burma Star men. But the place that I was just describing there in the Arakan was somewhere where my brother ended up too. And by curious chance, at one stage, we found that our postal addresses were roughly the same army post office. And by some near miracle, we were able to meet in Calcutta. And there was another Manxman there called Joe Qualtro, who used to work for, and did work for, the Manx electricity generating station, an honours degree man. And, you know, there were bad and there were some enlightening times. And I think I've gone about as far as I can on this tape without it running out on me. So I'll just stop here and have a little rest. Well, just to finish the tape, I'll recount the sort of experience that was common, really. I think I was driving a pickup truck somewhere, I don't know, a bit jungly anyway, and I think there were about three or four trucks making our way there. We stopped for a break, and when I got back to the truck, the monkeys had come aboard, and they had torn up everything, bits of paper, you know, documents, messed around the place there, pulled up seats and Lord knows what. And of course they were quite formidable. You had to be careful before you tackled them and chased them away, but they'd run away shouting, screaming and yapping away into the jungle there. And it certainly all seemed very far from home. A bit of a picture of the years, 3.5 years that were spent there. So much could happen. You would find that you might be threatened with joining the Chindits, and a lot of people were just taken from regiments, from signals, from companies, and would be flown into the depth of the Burma jungle with a wonderful leader called Wingate, and would try to harass the Japanese by moving around at night and so on, and supposedly being requisitioned by air, by parcels being dropped. But of course what actually happened was that instead of the supplies arriving regularly, they didn't, and sometimes they had to march out on their own, and their casualties were very, very high. Very little is known about the war in Burma, which was a very important affair because it concerned control of the Far East, and it was intent on destroying the British Empire, which it largely succeeded in. But had it gone on and been more successful, then of course the world would be a completely different place, and certainly we'd not be able to enjoy the freedom that we have now. I can't remember the dates exactly, but I know I ended up somewhere in a hut somewhere on the edge of the Aragon jungle there, and we were a sort of a forward signals unit and providing communications towards Akiab. And curiously, I think that's where Jack was part of the time anyway, in the Air Force, because I was in the Army. But our conditions were very grim then. It was sort of 24-hour work and train and guarding and all the rest of it. And I know there eventually sickness overtook me. There was a, I think if you could find anyone, because there was a warrant officer, Indian doctor, who really didn't know anything, really, and sort of said, you got malaise. Well, whether I got malaria, dysentery, I probably got both. I gradually grew weaker, because, of course, the entire unit would be either signal out at signals or just getting some sleep. And I think I would must have been days and days until I got weaker and weaker. I could hardly get out or move. And somebody reported it, I think. And I think one night a sergeant came and said, oh, my God, you know, we'll have to get an ambulance somehow. And they got an ambulance. They got me to a basha hut, sort of a hospital somewhere in the jungle there, where they put me in a basha bed, you know, with mosquito nets. And the chap next to me said, oh, he said, the chap in there died yesterday. He said, it's a bad place, this. Anyway, there were no nurses there. There was no doctors. There was one English sister, I think, who appeared, and there were one or two orderlies there, and I know I was quite delirious and very ill there. And then they came and they shipped me onto a riverboat, and it was there that I got my first quinine, I think, because we were all more or less stretcher cases laid out on the deck of this little paddle boat that paddled away up the river all day. And one English nurse came and poured quinine down all our open mouths, like a lot of chicks being fed. And then onto, I think, a little train, then onto a hospital train. And that was another 7 days, curiously, right into the central India there, to Mau, I think, and I forgot. I was in hospital there for quite a long time. And then I should think I did a 6 months convalescence up at a hill station, because we had all been serious. There were three of us in that room in the Arakan. One of them was paralysed from the waist downwards. He had infantile paralysis. A nice young chap, worked for Lever Brothers in London. And he went home to be in a wheelchair. And the other was a chap called Jock Munro, and he was a splendid footballer, and he lived at Thurso. You could understand his Scotch, but barely. But he ended up with Sprue, and I know years afterwards he was coming down to places like Manchester trying to see if there were any cure for this relatively incurable tropical disease. So India made its mark on us, so many of us, and I suppose I was lucky in the sense that I came home relatively in one piece. And I think that was a winter that I spent up at 7,000 feet, I think it was, Chakrata, a little hill station, and there were a lot of the survivors of the Burma campaign there who had retreated from Rangoon when the Japs broke in behind them, and they escaped by making their way through the jungle, and they came out ruined in health and subject to the most dreadful nightmares. You'd hear the going through it, you know, at night and so on. But it was a wonderful place in which you looked across at the Himalayas, a whole range, and K2 was near us. And many days you'd see a smoke plume going vertically from the top of K2, which was nearly as high as Everest. and that whole range of mountains. And when I got a bit fitter, I could walk up perhaps as far as 10,000 feet. And you had to be careful. You didn't go out at night there because there were leopards and there were baboons, whole gangs or colonies of baboons that were liable to set on people. And from there, I was sent back to join my unit, but they sent me instead to a different unit, Air Formation Signals, which was really providing signals for the RAF and a much, much cushier life than the army. Indeed it was. And I forget where they were based. I think I went all over the place there, Bombay, Bangalore, Madras, Cochin, providing supplementary signals for the RAF. And then came the next set of training in quite a different unit to retake the islands lost to the Japanese, principally Singapore, and landing in Malaya, and very severe jungle training there. When we went out to India, it was an offence to go outdoors in the hours of daylight without a topi and a shirt on and so on. And when night came, sleeves had to be rolled down, no shorts worn, only long, etc., etc. By the time we were then training for further things there, you were stripped to the waist with rifle on bare shoulders and whatever, and working in temperatures up to 140 degrees. I think we reckon there that it would be an ideal prison camp where we were training, because if it had barbed wire around it, it wouldn't be needed really, because it was a desert, mixture of desert jungle, somewhere in Orissa, I think, in the wild part of India where we were training there. And then we set off then on our long journey to get to the ports where we could embark and attack and regain some of our possessions on the way back to Tokyo. And I've forgotten how it happened. We'd certainly got to Calcutta and they didn't want us there. I think we were going to load at Calcutta for Rangoon, and Rangoon was in danger of being taken because our troops had advanced so quickly across Burma that Rangoon was liable to fall at any time, and we were switched then, I think, to Singapore, and then from Singapore to the Cocos Islands, and we moved on into Burma, and it was there that we celebrated VJ Day. But I'll pause here for a minute. Well, I remember we had to do a victory march somewhere, I don't know, somewhere in, not Pakistan, what's the other place in the borders of India, not Bengal. Anyway, it was a pretty wild country, and I've missed out an awful lot, inevitably. I think after one of the spells with malaria, and I don't know how many attacks of malaria, I had quite a lot, I was sent on leave, and it would so happen that Brother Jack was going on leave at the same time, and we met up in Kashmir. You could go to, I think, if you had leave, you were given 3 weeks' leave, and you could go to either Kashmir or another hill station in the central India, or Darjeeling. Well, I'd been sent to Darjeeling before, I think, and some of my photographs that I've been through reminded me of that, because troops are not the most good companions. I know when I got to Darjeeling, which is a wonderful journey up that little railway, they said there's a marvellous camp here, you can get drunk all day and stay in the morning and sleep it off, it's marvellous, mm-hmm. which didn't appeal to me in the least. And I looked at what was available, and there was a tea plantation that would take two people or something. So I put in for that and went many miles away from Darjeeling into hill country to a tea plantation run by one Englishman with a Eurasian wife, I think, from where do the Gurkhas come from?
Nepal,
a Nepalese wife, I think it was, and we were on the borders of Nepal, and the tea pickers were Nepalese, and of course I used to take part in the whole process of producing tea, which was produced for the people in the cities of India. He didn't export outside India, it was mainly India, so he was doing very well. And it was marvellous tea, the sort that you don't experience when it's grown at a height. And there again, this was, I think, about 7,000 or 8,000 feet. The tea has a different flavour and a much fuller flavour. And a big plantation, and I was given a pony and could ride all day till I could barely stand. And if I wanted to go and shoot tiger or cheetah, he would give me a bearer, which then again I wasn't terribly keen on. Certainly there were deer and so on to be had in that area, because we looked out across on Kanchenjunga, a mountain very close to Everest, where in the evening the sun would cause the snows to turn completely pink there. It was a magnificent sight and a majestic place to be in. And we're very fortunate to be there. But I don't know when it was later in the war. I think it so happened that my next leave was after I think I'd had malaria and up in Kashmir. And there, I think I met Jack there, I'm not sure, but certainly we both managed to stay at the steward's house to the Maharaja of Kashmir on his estate. And it was a wonderful change from war and the army, as you can imagine. And I know the steward pointed out to us a huge tree not very far from the house, which he said was the Maharaja's third wife, because being a Hindu, I think it was the done thing to marry a tree for your third wife. Well, I've not worked out the point of that quite, but Kashmir is very beautiful, lakes and mountains and wild country, and a lot of canals, a bit like a minor Venice really, where you can hire a shikari and be paddled around all day for a few bob, and little merchants would come alongside with similar shikari selling you fruit or gifts. Carvings were beautifully done there. You could pick up carvings quite cheaply, and you could go in and order a pair of shoes and they'd be made for you by next day, or you could order a suit and made for you next day. And I think we tried to send present home from there. Did any of them reach you from Kashmir?
You still got the cigarette box that you sent home?
Ah, yes, I sent a cigarette box. It's difficult to know what you could send. And this must have been getting on a bit later in the war, mustn't it? I don't know, I can't remember now. But
you sailed on the Shalimar, didn't you?
Yes, at Kashmir there. The song, the Pale Hands I Love Beside the Shalimar, well, part of the Maharaja's dwellings in his gardens were was Shalimar, and I was privileged or otherwise to be in one of his harems, which unfortunately was not occupied at the time. But, yes, that was an experience. India, I think, most people disliked. because mainly unhealthy was the food. You wouldn't even eat a piece of melon, really, because it might have been sufficiently exposed to give you a mild form of dysentery or whatever. You wouldn't want to drink anything unless it were tea that had been boiled and that sort of thing. Any water that you took was suspect. And of course, you had tablets to make it taste like nothing on earth if you were drinking from your own water bottle. Eventually, when the Americans started to arrive, you got things like K rations, which at least, you know, were reliable. But British Army bully beef and biscuits and things like that were standard rations to equip you for any length of time or any journey or whatever it may be. A tin of bully beef and some biscuits, bread and so on was not a very attractive feature of India, unless you were in the cities. And if you were in the cities, of course, like Calcutta or Bombay, the restaurants there, of course, were world famous. And at least there was no differentiation with rank there. You could go into Firpo's in the Chowringhee in Calcutta, and if you had the money, you know, you could get yourself a nice meal. And since you hadn't had any way of spending any money, then, of course, the troops would let themselves go whenever they got into Calcutta. And inevitably, in India, the travel had to be through the big centres.
Can I ask about the Calcutta famine? Were you there at the time of the famine?
Yes, that was a dreadful time. That was the Great Famine of 1943. And I think that it killed a million people. And I was in and around Calcutta at the time, and the destitution was terrible. What it was a shortage of rice. And these were people who, when they came to the cities, couldn't really eat anything but rice. And if you threw them a crust, perhaps they, you know, they didn't know what to do with it. You know, you would see sites like bodies left in those big dustbins that they had there. Every morning they went and picked up the starving. The army could do very little, really. This was an Indian problem. And in actual fact, it was part of the evils of war, really, where, with, I think, a rather poor crop, the merchants had gathered together the supplies of grain, stored them in their godowns or their warehouses, and kept hold of them, so that there was a grain shot up in price and people just couldn't afford it. And I think, as I say, a million people died. And it was the army that really that broke the famine, because the word went out that we've had enough, the troops are going to open up the godowns. And they literally went round the province of Bengal opening up these storehouses of grain. And of course the price came down right away, and the famine was more or less stopped. And it's very easy to explain shortage of food or whatever it is. Sometimes it's much more complex than merely having a bad harvest. If it's exploited by people or it's used politically, then there's no saying what damage it will do. But India was a terrific experience. I tried to persuade Margaret to go back and see some of the better side of it. I suppose I painted such a poor picture. But there again, I think one of our friends gave a missionary talk once, of a holiday they'd had in India, and it was to travel on the great trunk road all the way from Delhi to Nepal. And the experience was so terrible of the coach breaking down every day, of little hotels that were, when they saw the conditions that were so terrible, I don't think Margaret could be persuaded to go to even the poshest hotel in India. Though we know friends who backpacked there and seem to get away with it. It's an amazing country, and distances are vast. And I was fortunate that I travelled from on the Frontier Express almost up to Afghanistan to get to Kashmir there, or down to Madras, or to British Cochin, or to Bangalore, and so on. A whole host of places.
What about coming home from, was it Jalali?
Well, yes, I suppose in retrospect, although it seemed a terrible long time to us, VJ Day was in August, and we're all very worrying about how to commemorate it here in the Isle of Man. And Margaret is very keen to try and get the Reverend Eddie Cubbins' account of his sufferings in the jungle printed and published as a commemoration, and we hope that will come off. But you could hardly credit, of course, what had happened with the atomic bomb. There were no first-hand accounts for us, I suppose none for America. We were somewhere out in the jungle where there were no newspapers. I think there was a monthly, eventually, SEAC, as it was called, with Lord Mountbatten, did produce something for the troops in the way of a weekly magazine or a monthly magazine which gave a certain amount of news. But I don't think there's any sympathy at all for Japan and having one or two atomic bombs. To us, it was a great mercy, because, of course, the killing that would have continued, and when they were fighting at Imphal there, every Japanese would be killed because they would not surrender. Even if they committed suicide, that was sufficient. And when our troops advanced into Burma there, the Japs were up the trees or whatever there, if they weren't shot down, or if they were told to come down, they would shoot themselves rather than give up. And of course, when the account of the war in the Pacific is told, the Americans would take an island, I've forgotten the names of them there, 20,000 Japanese defending it, and they would defend it, and out of 20,000, 200 were taken prisoner. That was all. And if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb, the death roll in the Pacific and in Malaya and Burma would have continued at a terrible rate for both sides, because, of course, they were desperate fighters with the Japanese and would fight to the very end. And then once it was over, what to do, where to go? You know, it had happened so suddenly, nobody really knew what was going to happen. And in a sense, those of us who'd been out there more than 3 years were the veterans, because, of course, they'd brought out fresh troops to mount these campaigns, and there were a lot of troops there who hadn't been out, as we had been, right from the start in 1942. And I don't know how or where I got shipped, I can't remember now. I do remember that we were sent to a holding camp, which was Dulali. And if you know the army expression, anybody who goes Dulali has gone off their nut pretty well. And so I've been to Dulali, where I can say that, but I wasn't there for long. And we were sent down to board a ship. And at Bombay, this is there. Bombay's got a magnificent bay, a magnificent harbour. And there were two Atlantic liners berthed there. One was the Cunard Mauritania, which I'd seen launched at Camelades just before the war, and I was pleased to see that she'd survived. And the other was the Duchess of Richmond, a Canadian Pacific vessel that I'd been used to seeing when I crossed the Mersey to work. And we got aboard the Duchess of Richmond and set sail for home, I suppose, about the beginning of November. So it was about 2 or 3 months after the end of the war. And of course, she being a North Atlantic vessel was not suitable for going through the Red Sea. The heat there was pretty dreadful, in addition to which we had a fire on board somewhere beneath the panelling, and probably electric failure. I know the firefighters were out at night and so on. And by this time, the Egyptian canal had been opened, and we went through the canal this time instead of going round the Cape. And I know one of my pictures I looked at the other day was passing another huge Atlantic liner. I think she's Monarch of Bermuda, I think she was, packed with troops going out to replace us, because there was a job to be done in India. And of course, not long after came that awful time of killing when they declared India independent. But we progressed slowly, and still, of course, there was the air of secrecy about us, where we were going, when we would get there, how you could communicate with anybody, because I don't think we got off the ship, or any opportunity to get off the ship from leaving Bombay to Liverpool. And we got to the bar at the Mersey, which I recognised, of course. In those days, it was a bar lightship, I think. And we anchored there in quite thick fog. And I thought to myself, well, what a pity you can't get a letter ashore, a telephone ashore, or any sort of word to let them know that I'm getting near home. And I think I had been able to tell them that I'd be leaving India on a certain date, which probably would have reached home before me. But we stayed out at the bar there for an indefinite time. And then we sailed up the Mersey in November in quite a fog, having come from the heat of India, and back in normal khaki. And we came alongside the Liverpool landing stage, I suppose, about midday at the end of November. And marvellous, there was a band playing. Well, of course, a troop ship is so crowded, you can't find space to stand hardly. And we got on, at least I got on the foredeck there, packed with some of the more raucous members shouting rather unpleasant things about seeing girls again, which they hadn't seen for ages. And there was a band playing, and I looked around, and there was a group of people on top of the buildings there. You know, the buildings that used to be on the Princess Landing stage, there was access to the roof where people could say goodbye to the emigrants who used to leave Liverpool regularly. And I looked, and there was Margaret and her sister Grace, and I couldn't believe it, really. And I think they could see me, but I'm not too sure. Perhaps Mother remembers this.
I remember it very clearly indeed, because we had contact with who knew the shipping lines and the shipping movements, and they had let us know that a troop ship would be coming in. So we went across to Liverpool, and I must confess I was waving to the wrong soldier, but they all looked alike. And then I heard Harold calling, and we were very thrilled. But of course, we still couldn't get together. They were marched straight off, I think, to a hospital camp.
A troop train.
Yes, and he ended up in Catterick Hospital. But Grace and I celebrated, and we had a whole tea cake and a cup of tea, and that was a real celebration. But you ended up in hospital. That was November, and we hoped to be married on March the 2nd, soon afterwards.
We were sent out to Thirsk, first of all, to the race course at Thirsk, in deep snow, coming straight from India.
Just the place to send you.
Just the place to be. And I think we got a leave. I think we got a leave before Christmas. And I came home to find that my brother was already home and that my mother, who was very frail and had been through the bombing and had had a weak heart for many, many years, was welcoming both her sons home after all those years of war, which turned out to be 6 years for me. And I think, was I there for Christmas? I'm not sure.
You were sent for because your mother died.
Well, yes. I wasn't there for Christmas. I had, a week's disembarkation leave or something like that. And then I think it was Christmas somewhere at Thirsk or somewhere like that. And then quite early in January, I think at the time of Mother's birthday, which if I remember rightly was the 10th of January, by then I'd gone into hospital with Lord knows what, having had all these diseases and so on, and called suddenly by, I think, an orderly to say, oh, your name, Kelly, is news for you. Your mother's just died, which is not really the best way to learn news like that. But at least they did give compassionate leave. And I came home for the funeral for 2 days or something like that, I think, which was a terribly sad affair because the aftermath of war, travel and news and getting to things like funerals wasn't easy, was it? It was a sad time, and I think it played a part in planning our wedding, which we planned then, reckoning that I would be discharged by the end of February. In the meantime, we were sent even further north into Yorkshire to a camp, not Gainsborough. No, I ended up in hospital in Catterick, but somewhere further north. That was in deep snow. But instead of being home for, I think, the 2nd of March, was it, to be wed, I was ensconced in hospital there where their idea of treatment was they gave you a bottle of stout first thing in the day. Whether that was to build you up or what, I don't know.
Horlicks made in a bucket.
Well, yes, Horlicks made in a bucket, and a lot of wounded and sick men from various corners. And we rearranged the wedding for the 30th of March. And I got out and got my demob suit and whatever it was, £10, some enormous sum of money as a recognition of my services and an honourable discharge, and got home. I'm not sure whether I found whether I had a suit. Of course, having been bombed and having lost all the contents of your home, some of it had been regained, I think, by my sister, who had gone to live with mother in a different house, and were then living in Bebbington in Garth Boulevard, weren't they?
Bimstead Avenue.
Still in Bimstead Avenue, were they? I'm not sure when they moved. Sure. No, it was Garth Boulevard. Garth Boulevard. And the wedding was quite a quiet affair.
Everything was rationed.
Yes, you can tell your side of it.
Everything, of course, was rationed. I think we had an ounce of tea and about 2 ounces of butter for a week, but we did manage to make a cake, and people would give raisins or something like that as a wedding present, really, to make a cake. It was a very quiet wedding, and we often laugh because, of course, nobody wore white. Sometimes people borrowed dresses, but I had a very, very nice woolen suit. And my father by this time was dead, and my brother-in-law, Kenneth, gave me away. I've often wished I'd asked Mother to do it, but never mind. And we arrived at the porch of the church, and I could see Harold and Jack in the front of the church.
My best man.
Yes, everybody was there. And the caretaker, who was the major domo on these occasions, he said, "No, you can't go in yet." And after a while I said, "Well, please, can I go in now? Everything's ready." And he said, "No, we're waiting for the bride." So I said rather sadly, "But I am the bride." But things were rather like that. And we were given wedding presents, I think, of petrol coupons. We hired a car, didn't we, to go on our honeymoon.
Yeah.
Things were very difficult indeed. And, of course, getting a house.
Or clothes.
Or clothes. Clothes were all on ration, yes. And curtains. Everything was on a ration. And, of course, houses had been bombed all round there, and finding a house was extremely difficult. So we were very fortunate in a way that we had a biggish house, my mother's house. She was widowed, of course, by that time, and she was alone in it. So we made that into two flats, and we lived there until our baby, Adam, was a few months old, and then we moved to our own house.
That's
but
right.
I think that is almost the end of our story, isn't it? But I think you suffered for many, many years the result of India, and we certainly, you went out A1 and you came back C3, but at least you came back.